New numbers on COVID-19 testing in Texas tell us what exactly. An investigation shows untold numbers of tests aren't being counted. That story and more on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. An investigative report by the Houston Chronicle says many coronavirus test results are not included in official counts trying to chart the spread of COVID-19. We'll hear why not and what it means for efforts to stem the spread of the virus. Also, El Paso students reflect on the deadliest attack on Latinos in modern U.S. history 1 year on. And newsman Dan Rather on a plan to improve education. All that and a whole lot more when the Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this fourth day of August 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. 5,839 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Texas yesterday, a positivity rate of 13.6%. But there's a problem with that data. Untold numbers of Texans are getting tested, and those tests aren't even being counted by the state. So reports Matt Dempsey. He is data editor with the Houston Chronicle. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what tests specifically are we talking about here, and what is it about these tests that the results aren't making it into official COVID positive numbers reported by the state of Texas?
We're talking about antigen tests here, and these tests check for an active infection of the virus. There's two reasons why they're not being reported by the state. The first is the state and the CDC considers these probable tests because they're not PCR tests. They're not looking for like the molecular or DNA parts of the virus. But the other reason why the state's not publishing them is because the state doesn't know about them, doesn't have any idea of how many tests have been done or how many positives they have, because it's like resting under an avalanche of these positive test faxes that have been coming into their office.
Now, I want to be clear about something. You just used the word faxes. You mean this data is not being sent at all to the state of Texas? I thought that all of the test results were supposed to be sent in to health authorities. And why are they using fax machines?
Faxes are used because they think it's more secure for private information, private medical information. They should be using other ways. There are other ways they could use it, but traditionally, mostly doctors' offices and medical facilities are using faxes to communicate that information.
So if the state had both test results from both types of tests, would we have a better sense of how well the state is doing in curbing the spread of COVID-19? And is there any idea how many results are going uncounted?
I think so, that we would have a better idea of how far the virus has spread. I mean, I think that my team, Jordan Rubio and Stephanie Lamb, and I have been trying to figure out as much as we can how big that undercount is since they're not publishing it. What we have found is that there are 11 counties that have reported or some kind of antigen count. And from those 11 counties out of 254 in the state, we have about almost 11,800 antigen positives that we know of. But to measure all of them, we don't know. We need to have a better idea of how many tests have been done and where, you know, how popular it is, because it's going to be different in different areas. But we do know that antigen testing is increasing. It's on the rise, that the federal government is using it to surveil the virus in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And unless the state has a better idea of how many of those tests are being done and how many positives are coming out of their tests, those tests, then we are missing and going to miss a larger chunk of the virus that we know about, or the people with the virus, I should say.
Now, it's true what the state says, that these antigen tests are somewhat less accurate than the other tests, but there's a whole lot of confusion when it comes to testing. I mean, how do folks know what kind of tests they're getting and what should they be looking for?
I mean, you can ask if the swab is going to go all the way back of your throat. People describe the PCR test as being very uncomfortable. The antigen test is closer to more like a strep throat test. It's not as far back. But you can always ask. If you're getting a test, you should ask, is this a PCR test? Is this an antigen test? You should ask whether it's an FDA-approved antigen test, because that's really important. There's only two FDA-approved antigen tests being manufactured or sent around in the U.S. There's other antigen tests out there that are not as good. But the FDA approved ones are the ones that people should be asking for if you're wanting a rapid response one.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your reporting, you say this lack of data is about to get worse. How so?
Well, the federal government through HHS is sending thousands of antigen tests into nursing homes across the country, 20 plus in the state of Texas. And those tests, again, the positives from any staff or residents from those places won't be reflected unless somehow there's a different process for getting those results to the state. On top of that, one of the two major manufacturers for the antigen tests, which is a pharmaceutical company called BD, has distributed 750,000 plus in the U.S. so far, but it's expecting to manufacture 2 million tests a week by the end of September. To give you an idea of just how much more popular this test is becoming, because people want to know whether they're infected and they want to know now. So as the popularity of the test increases, it means we're going to have a less of ability to have a complete surveillance of how the virus is hitting Texas.
Has there been any response to the Chronicle's report from the Texas Department of State Health Services?
Generally, the state tends to hold to the line of we report PCR positives, but then they will also say that we're working on trying to publish antigen results and antigen totals, like they did with antibodies tests earlier in the pandemic, which evaluates whether you had the virus before. But it's going to be a challenge for them. They have to go through lots and lots of paperwork to figure out what those antigens are. And then there's issues of, because of this confusion, some counties aren't sending any of their antigen stuff to the state because they think the state doesn't want it, which is contrary to what the state has told us. Like Montgomery County in the Houston area specifically told us that they're tracking their antigens, but they're not sending that data to the state because they were under the assumption that the state wasn't interested in it.
Matt Dempsey is data editor for the Houston Chronicle's investigations team. We're going to link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Matt, thanks.
Thank you.
The Air Force is examining its practices with regard to race. For years, advocates have been calling attention to statistics that show black airmen are brought up for punishment much more often than their white counterparts. Now the service is under pressure to figure out why. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
When a young Chicagoan named Chris first joined the Air Force in 2015, he thought he was entering an environment where racism was mostly under control. But from the outset, other black airmen told him differently. Chris asked that we only use his first name to avoid damaging his career prospects.
They were telling me things like, you know, you as a black man, you have to watch your back and you have to work harder and you can't mess up the same way that white airmen mess up because you'll be looked at differently.
As his career progressed, Chris says the environment became increasingly toxic. He found himself the target of racial slurs, and even small transgressions came with mountains of disciplinary paperwork. But Chris says white airmen were usually given more leeway and guidance when they made the same mistakes.
I remember a guy, he came in hungover from Oktoberfest, and instead of giving him paperwork because he was late and hungover, the NCO said, you know, just go, just sit in the back, you know, sober up. But then when a black airman comes in and he's a couple of minutes late, it's automatic paperwork because you're late. Like, it's the biggest deal. Like, you come in late, you're disrespecting my time.
Chris blames that disparity for ultimately ending his Air Force career. He says he was drummed out for drunk and disorderly conduct and for unauthorized charges on a government travel card, which he blames on a scammer. In both cases, he says his superiors refused to hear evidence that would have exonerated him. Don Christensen is a retired Air Force prosecutor and head of the advocacy group Protect Our Defenders. He says non-commissioned officers and commanders make decisions about whether someone is punished and hold a lot of sway over the Air Force judicial process.
Being predominantly white, they have a tendency, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, have a bias that gives a benefit of doubt to white service members that they might have a closer relationship with than the black service members.
Protect Our Defenders analyzed Air Force data and found that between 2005 and 2016, black airmen were about 70% more likely than their white counterparts to be court-martialed or brought up on Article 15 charges. That's a form of administrative punishment where the commander essentially serves as judge and jury. Black airmen also suffer lower promotion rates and are vastly underrepresented in the officer corps. Even with that, Christensen says the Air Force is still missing large chunks of data about race and punishment. The service doesn't track most low-level infractions, like lateness, which can affect an airman's career progress. That's where he believes most discrimination takes place.
Probably the vast majority of reprimands don't involve the legal office in any way. And there's just no process right now where you have a good fidelity of what's going on.
He also wants to strengthen the appeals process, putting the onus on commanders to justify the punishments they dole out. While the Air Force hasn't yet made those changes, officials have acknowledged the need for more data on nonjudicial punishments like reprimands, counselings, administrative demotions, and involuntary discharges. The Air Force Judge Advocate General Jeffrey Rockwell testified before the House in June.
We don't have that data. We kind of know that's where the problem is. What we don't know and what we can't answer for sure is, are we mentoring everybody the same?
Air Force General Brian Kelly has been looking at bias in the context of promotion and recruitment. He concedes that minority airmen may have trouble assimilating and can accumulate small punishments that hurt their chances of promotion.
There's no denying that from our part. We accept the fact that there's bias in the system. We accept the fact that there's likely racism in our ranks, and we have got to work to eradicate it.
For now, the Air Force says it will hone its training on bias and cultural sensitivity and look for ways to bring more Black airmen into the service. It's also launched an investigation into how its promotions, recruitment, and judicial processes treat airmen of color. This is Carson Frame reporting.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans, with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That signal means it's time to check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you seeing on social media in Texas today?
Hey, David. Well, as first reported by NPR, 2020 census counting efforts are ending a month early at the end of September, seemingly under pressure from the Trump administration. On our Facebook page, Christopher Bart says, "It's hard to see this as anything but a failure to perform a constitutionally mandated task." And as for whether folks have actually filled out the form, this comment from one Texas Standard listener, "We filled ours out as soon as we got the flyer in the mail. The online portal was easy and convenient. There's no excuse not to do this, and we will be losing representatives because people are not filling this out." Personally, yeah, I was one of those derelict in doing so and took care of that just the other day rather quickly. Just a few of the responses we're seeing. Another developing story we're watching on social media: one of the largest school districts in the state, Austin ISD, may push back school until September 8th due to COVID-19. I'll be back with that story and more later in the show.
Yeah, on that census story, Texas was lagging behind most of the states in the U.S. when it came to completing those census forms. We're going to have more from listeners when Wells Dunbar returns with the talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As they look for ways to control the spread of the coronavirus, health officials in Houston are turning to an unlikely source, the city's sewage system. Houston Public Media's Katie Watkins tells us how wastewater is being used to help fight the pandemic.
It turns out your poop can tell researchers a lot about COVID-19.
Infected people, both asymptomatic and symptomatic people, shed virus in their stool.
That's Lauren Stadler. She's an environmental engineer and is part of a team from Rice and Baylor College of Medicine who are working with the Houston Health Department to test the city's wastewater for coronavirus.
And then we can determine the concentration of the virus in that wastewater sample. And the idea is that that would be reflective of the number of infected people that are served by that wastewater treatment plant.
Most metropolitan areas have just a handful of wastewater treatment plants, but Houston has a lot, 39 to be exact. Lauren Hopkins with the city's health department says this means each plant can give a snapshot of a certain segment of the population.
So if we sample each one of those, we can see 39 different measures of the virus load across the city.
The goal is to track how virus concentration levels change over time. This data can show where cases are increasing.
If we can use it in neighborhoods where we can't get people to come out and get tested, we can still understand what's happening in that neighborhood. If we can use that to get an idea about what part of the population is asymptomatic but still shedding the virus, that's also very helpful.
Hopkins says testing the wastewater would never replace clinical data, but when paired together, they're a powerful tool.
We use the combination of the clinical data and that trend and magnitude of the virus in the wastewater to rank the zip codes across Houston and look at clusters.
That guides where the health department sends extra resources, like mobile testing units. In the future, Hopkins says they hope to zero in on specific neighborhoods and facilities.
Using it at an even smaller level, like a manhole. And so in congregate living areas where we know that populations are at high risk, for example, maybe the jail or the, you know, a nursing home, even eventually a dormitory.
Even beyond the pandemic, wastewater epidemiology may play a bigger role in public health in Houston. Again, Stadler from Rice.
There's a lot of viruses, bacteria, other disease-causing agents that are shed in your stool. And, you know, wastewater-based monitoring really is a powerful tool.
For now, the team is taking wastewater samples twice a week and continuing to refine their method. I'm Katie Watkins.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Researchers at Texas Tech University are at work on a possible COVID-19 vaccine, and they report preliminary results are promising. The next step involves testing to see if it protects live animals from the virus. For this, they need small mammals, but not just any small mammal will do. Casey Ellingson at Texas Tech Public Media looks at the role transgenic mice might play in the race for a coronavirus vaccine.
The team at Texas Tech is getting ready for the next phase in testing their COVID-19 vaccine.
We'll then begin with our coronavirus discussion.
So Dr. Harvinder Gill leads the team. He's an associate professor of chemical engineering, and he's holding his weekly Zoom update with his team.
Last week, so we started for the gold nanoparticle.
We found there is actually a very good antibody response in mice.
Gill's team of four has been working on a vaccine since March, when the first coronavirus cases popped up in Lubbock. They already had a grant from the National Institutes of Health to develop a flu vaccine that would protect people for life with just one round of doses.
What we have also investigated is, can we use the same technology for making a COVID-19 vaccine?
They've been able to see how the antibodies that their vaccine produces in a mouse's blood interact with the coronavirus proteins. As the research moves to the next level, Gill has to use another lab, because his lab is only approved for work with regular mice. And regular mice lack a certain protein found in humans, called the ACE2 protein. It acts like a doorway into the body for the coronavirus. That's why genetically modified mice, also known as transgenic mice, are so important.
You take any sequence that you want. You can take a human sequence. You can take a fluorescent protein. You can take a plant protein, you can take any gene that you want and you essentially insert it into the mouse genome.
That's Dr. Kat Lutz with the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor, Maine.
It's kind of like designing a house.
Lutz is a neuroscientist who's been working with mouse genetics since the early 90s. Her lab mass produces and distributes these transgenic mice for vaccine research and development. A big part of her job is finding the best mouse models around the world. She's found one that she thinks might help find a vaccine for the coronavirus.
The model that we have, the K18 model from Stan Perlman, actually is turning out to be sort of the diamond in the rough.
That's a mouse model where in SARS, the mice got an overwhelming brain infection and died pretty quickly.
That's Stan Perlman. He's a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University in Iowa. He worked on a SARS vaccine, and despite the fact that his mice died when exposed to the virus, Perlman still saved vials of their sperm.
But with SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, they're a little more useful because the mice don't get so much brain infection, so they get more lung infection. That's what I was saying, so they're nearer to the human disease.
Which means they can be useful in developing a COVID vaccine. So once the pandemic hit, Perlman shipped those vials of sperm to Lutz and her team. Through in vitro fertilization, Lutz's team produced tens of thousands of these mice for use in labs around the world who are working on a COVID vaccine. There are concerns about the large quantity of animals needed for testing and whether alternatives can be used.
In the area of vaccine development, certainly alternatives work is absolutely critical to sort of the initial stages.
Nicole Kleinstreyer is looking into alternatives to animal testing. She's acting director of a department dedicated specifically to that. It's part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
But in terms of the, you know, the later stages of the process of vaccine safety testing, the short answer is no. There are no alternatives that are used or accepted for vaccine safety testing other than using animals or people.
Unfortunately, it's the only way to do it because you're interested not in just how a virus grows, but you want to know how it affects different tissue and how the immune response responds to it. So we're getting better at being able to put some of the human tissues into culture and just using that directly. But the problem is that you can't mimic the immune system.
I put it on the microneedles with the coronavirus peptides. And we gave the D10.
Back at the Texas Tech Lab, Harvinder Gill and his team are discussing a method of delivering the vaccine through a patch. They're testing the patch while waiting for the green light to test their vaccine on animals. We'll do that with a team at Utah State University. They have the facility needed to continue testing. Gill says it'll take about 60 days to find out if his vaccine works. I'm Casey Ellingson.
Well, invasive zebra mussels are expanding into more and more Texas waterways. Texas Parks and Wildlife says the mollusk menace has reached infestation levels in two more lakes, OHIV near San Angelo, and Grapevine Lake in the Metroplex. That means 21 total lakes in the state are what officials describe as fully infested. The mussels reproduce rapidly and can damage boats, clog water treatment infrastructure, and crowd out native species. More news in the Texas Roundup, which is just ahead.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott is traveling today to some areas in Texas hit hardest by the coronavirus pandemic. Texas Public Radio's Steve Short has more.
Nearly 450,000 Texans have contracted COVID-19 and more than 7,000 have died. Governor Abbott will receive an update on personal protective equipment and deliver remarks at the Texas Division of Emergency Management Warehouse in San Antonio. The governor will be joined by TDEM Chief Nim Kidd. From there, Abbott and Kidd will fly to the Rio Grande Valley for an update on the opening of the McAllen Convention Center. It's being converted into a healthcare facility to help meet the region's hospital capacity needs during the pandemic. I'm Steve Short in San Antonio.
The Texas Comptroller's Office reports sales tax revenues rebounded last month, showing a 4.3% increase over July 2019. The nearly $3 billion in receipts mostly is based on business activity in June, when widespread social distancing requirements were more relaxed across the state. Comptroller Glenn Hagar says after months of decline, the sales tax revenue increase was driven by retail sales, especially online. Tax revenue from sporting goods and recreational gear also rose significantly. Meanwhile, other major sectors such as construction and restaurants continue to post significant declines. Sales taxes are the largest source of state funding for the Texas budget. The number of Texas bars, restaurants, and liquor stores unable to pay their bills is surging amid the pandemic. The Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission's current list of delinquent alcohol retailers is nearly three times higher than a year ago. Spokesman Chris Porter says businesses selling alcohol for on-premise drinking are struggling the most.
What we're seeing is a much larger number of alcohol retailers, such as restaurants or bars, who are having difficulties paying their suppliers. And obviously, that's going to be due to the slowdown in business from the coronavirus pandemic. 1 year ago in July, we had approximately 175 retailers on the list, and this month it's greater than 400.
Porter says due to the economic downturn, TABC is not pursuing penalties for delinquent alcohol purveyors, such as fines and permit suspensions. And the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has issued ozone alerts for the Dallas, Fort Worth, El Paso, and Houston areas today. Dry, hot temperatures combined with light winds could make the air unhealthy to breathe for people with asthma and other sensitive groups. TCEQ says drivers can help reduce ground-level ozone by not idling for long periods of time. I'm Joseph Leahy from the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. 1 year ago this week, a Walmart in El Paso was the scene of the deadliest attack on Latinos in modern U.S. history. 23 people died after being shot, and dozens more were injured. The accused gunman, a 22-year-old white man who police say told them he was targeting Mexicans. A year later, the border community is still making sense of the mass shooting. Anahi Diaz, Victoria Almaguer, and Claudia Hernandez are student journalists at the University of Texas at El Paso. Diaz and Almaguer have lived in El Paso all their lives. Hernandez grew up just across the border in Juarez and moved to the city several years ago. They recently got together on Zoom to reflect on how they've changed since the shooting.
I think that day, it was just eye-opening for all of El Paso. Knowing that we are a safe city, but we're not safe from the rest of the world. In a way, this has made us more aware about the kind of target that we are. Just like who we are, that makes us a target.
We don't see ourselves as a minority. If anything, like here in El Paso, we're a majority of us. It's mostly Mexican. So if you don't go out of El Paso, you don't really get that culture shock or realization that we're actually a minority in the U.S.
I always felt like there was discrimination against Latinos and Hispanics, but I always thought it was like somebody else. And I always felt like, okay, I'm a minority, but I don't really suffer. I don't know, it opened my eyes.
We were mourning the victims. We were angry that our community was kind of invaded. We were angry that something like this happened in our city. But I think most of all, we were angry that this was an act of racism. And it's something that is so deeply rooted in our country and in our world that you just know this won't be the last time that we as a minority will be the target again.
I started double guessing if I wanted my future to stay in the U.S. because, I mean, I'm never going to have the perfect accent. I'm never going to change my last name. Like, I'm always going to be Mexican. And it took me a while to feel okay again. But honestly, it happens every time I'm in the U.S., in a UTEP auditorium, in the movies, the first thing I do when I go there is check, like, what would I do? Like, where would I hide?
Every time I go to the supermarket, I make a list now. I didn't used to make a list. It was just like, I'm just going to go to Walmart and I'm going to see what I can buy. Now it's like, okay, I need to buy this, and that's it. Like, I'm out of there.
When everything happened, my mom, she told us, she was like, if that were to ever happen to us, like inside a Walmart, inside a store, just know that I'm running for my life and know that you're running for your life and know, like, I have to look for my mom or I have to look for my dad. Where are they? Like, no, just like everyone run for themselves. I hope it's a talk that we don't have to tell our children, but it wasn't even like 24 hours later that another shooting occurred after the El Paso one. It's just really sad to know that, you know, we live in a world, in a country that accepts that kind of behavior and just lets it happen. Yeah. You know?
Once a professor asked, you know, who knew someone inside that Walmart? And a big portion of the class, like, raised their hand, like, oh, my friend's friend was in there, or my friend's brother was in there, my aunt's whatever was in there, just because El Paso is just that way, we somehow just know each other.
I'm not going back to the Walmart. I can't go back there and not think about, you know, the lives that were lost just because somebody decided one day I'm going to take their lives, you know?
I didn't want to give importance to the shooter as if he was going to win. Thanks to him, a whole Walmart shut down and people lost their jobs. So I think I'm also very, very conflicted about that.
I just hope that people don't forget about this event, but we can just continue to move, not past this, but maybe in a way towards this, towards these conflicts, and be able to resolve them as much as possible.
What I would hope is not to normalize these shootings.
We also need to create change that allows us, like people that look like us and people who have been affected by situations like these and discrimination and racism, to have a seat at the table and ask for the changes that we can only ask for because we have only experienced them. And so that's my hope for El Paso, and I hope it continues to remain strong, and I hope it continues to remain the beautiful city that all three of us know. And I wish the same for Juarez.
Anahi Diaz, Victoria Almaguer, and Claudia Hernandez are students in the Audio Journalism and Podcasting Research course at the University of Texas at El Paso. This story was produced by KERA's Mallory Falk. We have more on the El Paso shooting over at texasstandard.org. We're coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
My name is Armin Salek, and I'm the recipient of the 2020 Rather Prize for the Best Idea to Innovate Texas Education. We started the first high school legal aid clinic in the country. The students in the Legal Eagle internship, or the Eagle Aid Clinic, are 16, 17, 18 years old. So these are juniors and seniors at Aikens High School. And what that means is that we have the first cohort of high school students working on real legal cases, immigration, wills. Our students were particularly excited about handling gender marker and name changes at the end of the year. Unfortunately, due to COVID, our gender marker and name change clinic was canceled. But we are very excited about bringing that back in the fall, or maybe even the spring, depending on what COVID would allow. And through that clinic, the students at our school will be able to tell students who do not identify with their name or gender marker that we support you, and we will help you get the identification that matches the way you see yourself. When I was in law school, I would say that of my 10 closest friends, 8 or maybe even 9 of them had a parent that was an attorney. The folks that end up in law school are not random. It's not a cross-section of society, it's a very select few. And what we are trying to do is create a pipeline for underrepresented populations into the profession. Law should be a place to advocate regardless of where you start. And we are trying to give these students an opportunity to take that next step, to see themselves as attorneys, as the prosecutor, as a defense attorney, as the plaintiff attorney, instead of as a defendant. I took a family law course in law school, but I really learned family law through my students. They will tell you when a child can provide their opinion for which parent they want to live with in a family law court. They'll tell you about situations where they were in immigration court watching a parent in deportation proceedings. So they have a passion that comes with all of those years of background of dealing with criminal courts, family courts, juvenile courts, immigration courts, whatever it might be. They come in knowing that, you know what, I saw something from that attorney that I want to replicate, or I saw something from that attorney that nobody deserves. And at that age, it's hard to get taken seriously in the legal profession. But once the attorneys and judges see our students in action, they realize, okay, these students can do it. You know, my students argued in front of a Supreme Court justice, a Texas Supreme Court justice this year, and I think he was blown away. The $10,000 that we received from the Rather Foundation will make a huge impact, and we're not just going to use that for Aikens High School. That's going to plant the seed for legal aid clinics at Navarro High School, Eastside Memorial. You know, Aikens High School is going to be our model school, but we hope to expand beyond that. That's the seed that I'm so proud of planting. We call ourselves the Legal Eagles. My name is Armin Salek, the winner of the 2020 Rather Prize, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
The Rather Prize is an annual $10,000 prize awarded by the family of Texan and longtime journalist Dan Rather through his grandson Martin. A board of experts chooses the winner. The family awards the prize. To talk a bit more about the award, the longtime CBS newsman and nightly news anchor joins us now. These days, Dan Rather is the host of The Big Interview on Axis TV and a frequent traveler of the social media pathways these days, too. I see you on social media quite a bit, Mr. Rather. Good to have you back on the Texas Standard.
Very good to be back with you, David. Thank you very much for having me on.
Let's first begin talking about the Rather Prize, because the last time you were here, I believe it may have been right around the time that you had your first winner of the prize. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the Rather Prize and what it's all about.
Well, the Rather Prize, this is our fourth year.
Fourth year, okay.
The Rather Prize was started as an idea with my oldest grandson. I have two grandsons, my oldest grandson, Martin. When he got to be about 17 years old, his grandmother, my wife Jean, said, you know, Martin, we've been very blessed and in many ways privileged. It's time for you to start thinking about how to give back. And frankly, he surprised us. He said, how about a prize for the best idea to improve Texas schools? This year's winner is Armin Salek from Aikens High School here in Austin. He leads a group called the Legal Eagles. The idea is to educate young people in what the legal system is, how lawyers work, how cases are developed, to introduce them to the legal system. And he's had remarkable success with this. It's a great idea, which we're hoping that other schools will pick up the idea and work their own plan for doing this kind of thing. But that's basically what the prize is. It's a $10,000 prize each year for the best idea how to improve Texas public schools. I'm particularly pleased to be part of it because as a product of Texas public schools, it grieves me. You know, every year when the ranking of public schools in the nation come out, in some recent years, Texas has been as bad as 39th or even worse in the 40s. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're Texans. We don't want to be 39th in anything, much less in schools.
That is wonderful. And, you know, it's interesting that it would be about trying to connect with the legal system, especially as there's been such a huge conversation of late about the legal system and, frankly, systemic racism in the legal system, what with people pushing for change, not just in the police, but also in criminal justice, especially. What have you made of what you've seen and learned in the reporting on Black Lives Matter and the current push for change in systemic racism?
Well, first of all, there's no question that we're at a special moment. A special moment in this sense. There have been remarkably large and consistent demonstrations in the streets against racism. And what strikes me is that the diversity in these mass protests, we've had these in the past, for example, back in the 60s, there were some, but never protests that were as diverse as these. The diversity in terms of race, religion, gender, age, these cut right across the board. Now, whether this particular moment in the arc of history of the remarkably diverse mass movement in the streets actually results in some substantive changes, we're about to find out.
I'm curious, what these days brings you hope and joy, and what breaks your heart on the other side as you think about where we are now at this moment in the arc of history, as you describe it?
Well, you know, what brings me joy is family, friends, and the knowledge that our country, we're a resilient people. We're going to get through what we're going through now. It may take a long time. It may take a while, but we'll come out the other side. And as a lifetime optimist by experience and by nature, what gives me encouragement is believing that up ahead there are better days. I've been so blessed, let's face it, in so many ways and so lucky that I worry that I'm not doing enough and that we, all of us, are not doing enough to help the hungry, the homeless, the heartbroken, the helpless and the voiceless, the people in the underside of our country and of society. When I have dark thoughts about, you know, I'm not doing enough and we're not doing enough, it's generally in that category.
Dan Rather is host of The Big Interview with Dan Rather on Axis TV, which has just recently started resuming doing interviewing amid this pandemic. He is also the former anchor of the CBS Nightly News, a longtime newsman, of course. Mr. Rather, thanks so much for taking a bit of your time with us to speak on the Texas Standard. Good to talk with you again, sir.
Good talk with you, David. Good luck. Godspeed. I'll see you along the trail.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The verbal threats come randomly. While grocery shopping or walking down the street, Asian Americans in the Texas capital city and nationwide, for that matter, say they're hearing more verbal threats and slurs during this pandemic. Here to talk about harassment that Asians are hearing more since the coronavirus first surfaced in China earlier this year is Ho-Jin Choi. He is a reporter for the Austin American-Statesman. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Ho-Jin.
Thank you for having me, David.
We've seen an increase in harassment of Asians and Asian Americans in the United States. What about the people that you've reported on?
We spoke to three individuals from the Austin area, and all three individuals, when they spoke to me at least, described the situation in which they were kind of verbally attacked and the targets of verbal assaults in public.
For example,
one of the sources we spoke to is Jasmine Yuan, who is a Chinese individual, Chinese American, lived in the United States for 13 years. And she described a situation in which she was actually just in the grocery store parking lot and a car drove by and yelled Corona before driving off. We spoke to a local DJ named Michael Pendon, who is of Filipino descent, born in the United States, actually. And he was, while he was biking near the UT campus, he was called homophobic slurs as well as racial slurs. And we also have a Korean individual who also talked to us about, while they were running in the Austin area, how they went through a variety of different, almost kind of like bullying type of assaults.
Are police trying to keep track? Is anyone trying to keep track? Is there any way of qualifying or quantifying the numbers here, or is the data incomplete at this point?
Now, at the national level, we do have this group called Stop AAPI Hate. Who is tracking the data. At the local level, we have a group called the Austin Asian Community Health Initiative, which is also actually working with Austin Public Health to collect data. We did reach out to APD, and what they do recommend as of now is to keep track. And if you're a target of these attacks, obviously, first, if you feel like you're immediately in danger, get out of the situation and call 311 or 911. But they do ask that, you know, if they did say that keeping track of this helps the police department see if there is a pattern emerging.
What about cases of violence in Austin, and what can Texans do if they're subjected to this type of harassment?
Absolutely. So first of all, if they're at all feeling threatened, immediately threatened, get to a safe place, call 911 or 311. But what law enforcement officials have told us is that, you know, it really does help if it's possible to try to record these situations and to provide evidence for them, right? Another thing, though, is that if you let's say you're not a target of some of these attacks, but you're a witness to it, since a lot of these things are happening publicly, you know, offer help. You know, sometimes these individuals who are maybe of Asian descent who are targets of these things, English might not be their, you know, first language. So, I mean, you can help others in terms of telling them where they can report these types of attacks. And the resources such as Stop AIPI Hate, which has like an online form in 10 different languages that you can go and fill out online, as well as the Austin Asian Community Health Initiative, which also has their reporting form online that's pretty easy to fill out. It's pretty self-explanatory, but those are definitely some of the things that people can do to start kind of tracking this trend.
Some people listening might think, well, if it's not a physical altercation, if someone is just shouting an epithet or something, should they report it to the police? What I hear you say is that officials are saying call 911.
Right. And there it's racial hate crimes, regardless of if they are physical. Obviously, physical is very obvious when someone's physically assaulted. But these verbal attacks certainly do have an effect on people as well, psychologically, as well as how these people go about their daily lives. You know, one of the sources told me that they don't go grocery shopping anymore. So into the effect that what police are saying is that please do report these crimes to the police. So that they can keep track of any type of trend or if there is a pattern that's rising here locally.
Ho-Jin Choi is a reporter for the Austin American Statesman who's been covering this story. Ho-Jin, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you very much.
And you were listening to The Texas Standard. Well, that signal means our social media editor is back. Wells Dunbar has been monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Mentioned this one earlier, and it has some folks talking. One of the largest school districts in the state, Austin ISD, may push back school until September 8th due to COVID-19 issues. The AISD board votes later this week, and the proposal is there to help with COVID-19 precautions and also the transition to digital learning. But it also comes after state lawmakers declared that local health authorities do not have the power to delay the start of schools. Only school districts themselves can make that call. So obviously a lot of politics embedded in this decision, and that's something our listeners and friends on social media are picking up on. Via Facebook, Lisa Flores laments that our schools are stuck between what she calls a horrible power tug of war between local health authorities, the governor, and the TEA. She says that state lawmakers only want local control to blame schools, but not to give them any real decision-making power. If schools don't open in person, then they won't get funding. So obviously a developing story, one that we're keeping an eye on, and just the sort of, I guess, you know, fears, I guess you could call them, about those first days of school are prevalent. You know, one thing I've seen going around on Twitter today is what purports to be a photo of the first day of school in a Georgia school district, where it just shows teenage children just crowded together in a hallway, only one or two masks visible. And additionally, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, all slated to begin school this week, is my understanding.
Yeah, it's. I know a lot of parents are quite concerned indeed about the possibility of sending their kids back into the classroom, and yet a lot of parents really don't know what they're going to do once classes resume, because they have their own work schedules, and it's hard to monitor the kids and make sure that they're prepared and ready to go when those Zoom classes start. It's a tough situation for a lot of parents too.
Yeah, and that's the situation for the parents that are fortunate enough, you know, to work at home. Obviously, obviously a story with lots of dimensions. A top story in my Twitter feed this morning, one that I've seen shared by several people, article in the New York Times, the headline, "When COVID subsided, Israel reopened its schools. It didn't go well." They note that confident that they had gotten past where they were with the coronavirus, David, within days, infections were reported at a Jerusalem high school, became the largest outbreak in a single school in Israel, possibly the world. So obviously lots of folks keeping an eye on what's going to happen this school year, deciding.
And this, as administrators really try hard to try to protect kids, but try as they might, as we're seeing in that story from the New York Times that you mentioned, it's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm, decidedly so. And again, you know, all last week we heard about the risk of COVID-19, how that's been used to essentially do the forced expedited removal of many migrants at the border seeking asylum. I see a new report, a joint report between the Texas Tribune and ProPublica today. Thousands of migrant children expelled by the Trump administration since March, some held in hotels without access to lawyers or family. Now advocates say many are, quote, virtually impossible, close quote, to find. Another story developing on social media, David.
We're out of time for the broadcast today, but you can keep up with the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.